Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. All right, everyone, I want to welcome you back to this episode of One Broken Mom. Today, I have with me Richa Badami. She is a healer, author, and a survivor of sexual abuse. And I know this is a topic that we talk about quite a bit on this show because in and of itself, talking about sexual abuse is sometimes taboo, but more often than not, it's laced with so much shame and guilt that it needs to be a topic that those of us who can bring it forward for others to be able to understand that they may not be alone in this. However, I've also noted that when I publish my shows and I'm looking at the statistics, either on the videos or on the downloads, I actually see that there's a really high number related to it, higher than I might actually anticipate when you look at the engagements, you know, on social media. And so I believe that's because there are far more people than we actually realize who are suffering in silence with their traumas related to sexual abuse or being molested as children and maybe teenagers. And so that's why Richa is on the show with me today. Because her reasons for why it would take her years to get to treatment, to overcome the damage inflicted on her due to these abusive actions, is due in part to cultural taboos within her community. And she's detailed this journey in her memoir, Coming Home to the Heart, and she's here to tell us her story. So welcome to the show, Richa.
Thank you, Ami. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. I'm glad we connected. Actually, to let everybody know, Richa actually reached out to me several weeks ago. Of course, when you're in the community of healing and gathering and trauma, we're always kind of out there trying to find who else is in the sphere with us to learn from and to connect with and collaborate with. As I had mentioned, before we started recording, well, technically we were recording it, but it's not in the show here. I don't think of myself as the end for people when they're looking for trauma. I think of myself as the person who helps guide and connect and make links and opportunities for other people. And so it's always important for me to know, you know, everybody that's actually out there in the world. And so I do appreciate, you know, like when you reached out, it's like, all right, another cool person to be able to add into my realm of people that I know. So thank you
right
for doing
back
that.
At you. Right back at you.
Cool.
It was great to connect with you.
Yep. So, I'll say this at the end, but everybody else can connect with her too, because I'll have all of her links and everything in the show notes. But I want to start, let's just like jump in and dig into this. Yeah. Introduce yourself to the listeners and the viewers of the show. Let's start to hear about your story and why we're going to talk about your experiences today.
Thank you, Ami. Thank you for that. Again, my name is Richa Badami, and I was born in India. I was born in the north of India in a place called New Delhi. It's actually the capital. And at the age of about four, we moved to the south to a city called Chennai, which is now called Chennai. It used to be called Madras. I was born in the 70s. Initially, we were living in a joint family. So I was born into my family. My parents were very young. I think my mother was 20 when I was born. We were living with grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And then when I was four, we sort of split off as a nuclear family to the south of India. And then it was just my parents, my brother and I, and then my younger brother was born. And he was born when I was four. So now we were this nuclear family, and life seemed really great, really closely bonded with both sets of grandparents, cousins, uncles, and aunts, and, you know, just traveled back and forth from the south to the north over summer breaks. And it was, things were going really ideally as a child at the time. And at around 8-9 is when we moved from one city, from Madras to a city called Hyderabad. And in Hyderabad, my dad started a business, and there was things that were just not going really well, I think, at the time. But what happened then was what really changed the trajectory of my life. My dad was, I believe he was also, an alcoholic, an addict. And that was the first time I remember when I had chicken pox as a child. I was in the fifth grade, and it was a summertime, and I was really, really itchy, and I didn't, couldn't fall asleep. And that was the first time I was sexually abused by my dad. And, at the time in my body, I remember just feeling really weird about it. I wasn't sure what was happening. And I was like, okay, this is my dad though, right? Like everything's good because I trust this person. And I didn't know that that was abuse. And that started at that age at around just before sixth grade. And it continued on and off, mostly while I was asleep. And it was something that then later on I was told and groomed into, don't tell your mom, and all of that happened. All through that middle school and then high school, I found myself getting more and more lonely, more and more confused about boys, about, how am I supposed to be? Am I supposed to be more covered up, or am I supposed to dress like my friends? Or there was a lot of confusion, and psychologically really confused. I did come out and tell my mom when I was 13, and she didn't believe me. And she said that I was jealous of her, and I was making it up. But to her credit, she did go ask him, and to his credit, he didn't deny it. Because I think he was trying to not be that, and he couldn't help himself in whatever, not making excuses, obviously. But In hindsight, I'm 25, 30 years out from that time of my life, more than that, actually, that I look back, and there's been a journey between then and now that has given me a lot of growth. But at the time, it wasn't like that. I was suicidal. I was depressed. I tried to hurt myself. I didn't have any friends. I stayed very, very quiet. I was a very vibrant kid too. I loved theater. I loved dance. I loved music. And then I would go into the complete shell, and I wouldn't want to be around anyone. I was scared. I didn't know how to be with people. I didn't know how to talk to people. But I could act. I could get on stage. I could do a role. I could be in theater. I could be in films and TV. I did all that as a child growing up. I was in some form of media from the time I was 4 years old, actually even younger than that. I was a child voice artist, then an actor and stage and commercials my whole life in India. And I've done movies and TV and all of that. It was safe, makeup, lights, camera, action. I'm ready. I'm on. Let's go. No problem playing someone else. No problem learning lines to another human's journey. But when it came to being me, it was the scariest thing. It was the scariest thing. So I would hide. I would lie. I would cheat. I would, make up stories at school to say why I failed chemistry. I said I was being beaten up at home. I was being denied food. I was making shit up. Just because I couldn't speak about the real thing that was happening. I was making all kinds of stuff up. And it was really, really hard because I was really close, very close to my brothers. I still am. It was like we were twin souls we were one, like the three of us. And I couldn't tell them. I couldn't tell them what I was going through. And that was killing me on the inside, because I could talk to them about everything, and they could talk to me about everything, about their crushes and their girl, like the girls they liked, and whether, we would cover for each other and do silly stuff, and we were one team. And yet there was this huge thing that I could not tell anybody, because I swore to my mom I would not do that. And I kept my vow. I kept my vow. I kept my promise. You know, she didn't know any better. That was the best she could do at the time. And it took me decades to actually realize the damage that had done, because I'd only noticed the damage the actual abuse had done. And I was mad, angry, pissed off, and hated my dad and all of that, went through that whole phase. But it was like much later when I became a mom, I'm like, hold on, what the just happened there? Like, I would have never, like, how, what? And then it's like, my head almost exploded. I remember having a 6-hour call with my mom one day. I think it was Thanksgiving, like 10 years ago or something. And I'm like, no, hold on. What, why didn't you do something? And she said, well, I didn't do anything. Like, okay, well, I think that's the problem. Like, you should have done something. Like, do you ever have that feeling? Like, when you didn't realize that you should have been mad about something. And then you realize.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, not only did I go through that, but I didn't know what I was going through. And now and it's like, just like this backup, you know, stored reservoir of unexpressed whatever, you know, just abandonment and rejection and not knowing my worth, not knowing my value, not ever being modeled, that never being, you know, of course I got compliments on, oh, look how pretty you are. Look at those eyes. Look at your smile. Look at your hair. The dress looks so nice. And it had become like white noise to me, because I didn't feel like I was actually being seen, like who I was, what my experience was not being honored, acknowledged, even see. In fact, it was being completely denied. Mm-hmm. It was like, no, that never happened. Don't tell anyone. Don't talk to anyone. It never happened. And so I went about my life, festivals and birthdays and family weddings and cousins and everything, like my grandparents, who I was so close to, I could not tell them. My cousins and aunts and uncles, who I was so close to, could not tell them, because it was my dad, and he was on his own journey, and his journey led him to priesthood, and he became an Indian Hindu priest, Vedic priest, and he was officiating weddings and birth naming ceremonies, and he would wear the whole outfit and the priest outfit. And I mean, it manifested. Talk about how it manifested. It manifested in my body. I had, that was that period that I had no allergies. I had nothing. I was totally healthy. And then everything, like air, I was allergic to air, like the smallest amount of dust, smoke, anything. I mean, if I was breathing, I was allergic. It was almost like I was allergic to life. And it manifested in aches and pains and depression and being overweight as a teenager and lack of support, social, emotional, all of that. You know, I was lucky that it didn't manifest into something more serious and damaging, and that every suicide attempt was not successful. I even remember a creepy night. Creepy only now, but it was very real for me, standing over my parents at 2 a.m. when they were fast asleep and literally planning how I might, you know, kill my dad. And then I looked over to my mom and I'm like, well, she's never going to survive that. So, you know, that's not going to work, because then I'm going to be liable for her wellness and her happiness, because she won't know what to do. And so I'm like, I walked away from that. So I had plan A was to kill myself. That didn't work. Plan B was kill him. That didn't work. And then plan C was wait for him to die. Then I'll maybe have a life. And all that ABC plan changed when I became a mom. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh no. I don't owe anyone anything. I owe me to be whole, complete, happy, and present to this little one who's looking back at me with like eyes of, you know, you know, I'm here for you. Like, well, yeah, we are here now. And it's like, okay, everyone else, get back in line. No one else is important right now. This is the most important thing for me. And I think that my children, and not just children, my daughters, three daughters, because I thought God and I had a deal. Like, I'd paid my dues. You'll only give me boys if I ever have kids. And lo and behold, I have one daughter. I'm like, okay, all right, I get it. No worries. I'll deal with one. Then the second time, I'm like, okay, this one's got to be a boy. That's girl number two. And then I'm like, okay, I don't know who's laughing here, but this isn't funny because it's some sort of cosmic joke. And then when my third daughter was born, I was like, okay, I get it. I have to really pause here. Because I think I'd been fighting being a girl myself. Mm-hmm. I'd been rejecting my femininity because my femininity, my womanhood, my being a girl got me in trouble. Being attractive got me attention, which got me in trouble. Everything led to pain. Being a woman, being a girl always led to pain. And I rejected that in myself, and I rejected that for having daughters be my be coming into my life. Like, no, not for me, you know, not for me. But no, it was for me. It was exactly for me. And it was for the divine purpose that I found, that I feel I was born with, frankly. I mean, you know, I look back, and I look back to the moments where before the abuse even began, I had a really, I think all babies do, all children do, they have this pure connection to spirit, to nature, to music, to breath, you know, to the earth. They have that. And I remember having that. I remember being in my grandmother's lap at, you know, ceremonies or festivals and singing and chanting and mantras and doing, you know, ceremonious, beautiful, beautiful ceremonies in the tradition, Vedic tradition. And so I'm very fortunate that I had grandmothers who, much to my cousins' jealousy, or, you know, a lot of my cousins say, oh, you're her favorite, you're her favorite. And they didn't like me for that very much. But I see the balance in that, because I got grandparents that fed me that love and showed me I was lovable, and gave me a sense of inner knowing of the truth of what unconditional love looks like. Because for a long time, when my parents were sick, they couldn't give that to me. There was a lot of surface level stuff they gave, you know, food, shelter, clothing, and of course, between then and now, our relationship has been, you know, gone through so much healing and transformation. My father's been in my life. My mother's been in my life. We are a family again. But it's been a real journey, a real path of walking through a lot of painful manifestations in adulthood, which were the sort of invitation for adult onset of trauma in mm-hmm. different ways and forms. But it all began when that one night with chickenpox, and my journey changed, and then going through the years and years of being lost, depressed, lonely, isolated, not knowing who I am, never really even believing what came out of my own mouth, because I couldn't trust myself to trust myself. Everybody probably had an ulterior motive, you know, is how I always looked at people. Or if I did dare to trust, oh, well, it was just a matter of time before I was going to be hurt. And it was just a matter of time before the other shoe was going to drop. You know, you're familiar, you've heard this before, but it was a really difficult. And then being an Indian girl in the 80s and 90s, I turned 18 in 91, I think, if I'm doing the math right. And I had gone into college, and I had always wanted to study psychology, because ever since I told my mom which was in middle school, and that didn't go anywhere, and I didn't speak about it again, I realized I had to figure this out myself. And so I was hell-bent on studying psychology. I wanted to be a psychologist. I wanted to be a counselor. I wanted to first fix me. Like, I wanted to go back into the lab and work on myself. And while I had this candy store front going on with my happy outgoing life, I wanted to work in the back in the meth lab. That was me.
Breaking Bad and back.
Breaking Bad. And I go into college. The number one college for the psychology department in all of India. It was in my town, and I got in, and I was so happy. I screamed for a whole day. I got psychology. I got psychology, literally a whole day. And I start off as a very enthusiastic learner. I'm like that even today. I'm like, bring out my new composition notebook and new, you know, stationery and pens and pencils, and I want to learn. You know, I love learning. And I still have that, thank God. However, what happened in that first year of psychology was that during that year, we were told as potentially future counselors to experience what psychological counseling was like. They offered free counseling. So I'm like, awesome, perfect. This is what I needed. This is all working out for me. Well, I scheduled sessions with my professors over the year, and one after the other, I tried three different counselors, and each one of them, when I shared with them, this is what was happening in my home, turned around and told me, well, this sounds like a family matter. You should take it up with your family.
Whoa.
Not once, not twice. All three times, including the head of the college, the what they call the principal or the, I don't even know what they call it now. But
like a dean or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The main direct college, the topmost.
Yeah.
I remember writing like a 35-page letter, pouring my heart out, asking for help, and I got no response. Okay. That's when at that age, at 18 and a half, I snapped. Like, that's when I snapped. I was like, you know, I literally had a fuck it moment. Like, you know, fuck this. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody at home, nobody outside, even the bloody psychology department. Are you kidding me? Why do I want to be a counselor? Screw this. However, I know that this had a lot to do with the culture that I was in. I was part of. I was not only in India, I was in South India, much more conservative. And I don't know if it would have been any different in the North. I have no idea. I know where I was. It didn't work out for me. What it did do is finally give me the impetus to figure out a way to leave home. And that was something that no girl back in the 90s, 18-year-old ever leaves home in India. It's not a thing. You don't do that. Maybe now girls do that more, but this was like a way back, you know, some mm-hmm. 30 years ago. And so it was, you know, you finish college and you get married and then you leave home. And that wasn't going to be my path. And so I went away during the summer. I went back to Delhi. My uncle passed away, and my uncle was my dad's older brother, who in my head was sort of my replacement dad, because he was very fond of me and he called me every Sunday. He lived in Spain, and he and I was super close. And in my mind, he was like, I had replaced my dad with him. He passed away. Hmm. And that pushed me, like I snapped some more. Mm-hmm. And I remember going like, I think three weeks of just crying from morning to night, like 24/7, not sleeping, not eating, just crying. And my father was traveling with me to Delhi for the funeral and everything, and to see my grandmother. And he and everyone else assumed it was because my uncle had died. And while that was the straw that finally broke my back, it was everything else, like my complete hopelessness and loss of like I didn't know what to hope for anymore. That's when I met my maternal uncle in in Delhi. And when I finally poured my heart out to my cousin sister, who's my older cousin sister who actually lives in California now. And she dragged me back to the house and told her dad, who is my uncle, my mother's brother. And he completely got the picture. And he said, you have to leave home. Your mom's not going to do anything. And she's his sister. And he knew she's not going to be able to. He said, and they already lived in the U.S. And he said, I'll send you a ticket. Just come to the U.S. This was in 92. I said, I'll figure something out. And so I went back home and I declared this to my parents that I'm leaving. And I moved out and I moved up to the north of India to Delhi, where my grandparents and all were. But I got my own apartment, which was a little, you know, a single car garage, a room above the single car garage. That was mm-hmm. the size of my entire apartment. It had a bed, a kitchen, a bathroom. You know, it was this tiny little thing. And I loved it. I mean, well, I say I loved it, but it was horribly painful to be alone after being, you know, with my brothers my whole life and still not having told them why I was leaving. It was just like, okay, 1 year of college is done. I'm out. And they're like, what's going on? You know, my brothers had no idea. I finally told my older brother right before I left. And I'm glad I did. But then that shook his world after that, which was really a whole other crazy thing. But at least I felt like I finally had my friend back. You know, I had my brother who I could confide in and talk to and have in my life again. And so that's how it got me to that first step. You know, when we were talking, you said, what was the first big move? I think I tried to do a lot of small things throughout my life. But I think at 18, I think that was my biggest badass move for that time and stage and place. And all of it was exactly, the timing was exactly what it was supposed to be. Did it go great after that? No. Was it all beautiful? No. Was it hard like hell? It was very hard. But it was the beginning. You know, healing and transformation is, if anyone says it's easy. No, it's not easy. It's very hard. However, once you do that hard work, it does become easy. And because I found myself building so much self-awareness, self-knowing, self-knowledge, resilience, learning how to take care of myself, to actually be in charge of my life. And it was not perfect. By no means was it even close to perfect. But it was one step at a time.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
You know, it was hard. It was hard. My parents and I, we continued to work long distance. And my mother would come and go. And I didn't see my dad for a long time after that. But then after some time, I did start having some conversations with him. I had an early marriage. I got into this relationship in Delhi and we decided we're just going to get married, and we got married and turned out to be, he was an addict and alcoholic, had no idea at the time. And it was just this way of, oh, for my parents, partly it was, well, let's just get the girl married. Then all the problems will like transfer, you know.
It'll be the new husband's problems to take care of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And bad idea, bad plan. And that didn't last. It was like, I even forget sometimes I had that marriage because it was like in and out, you know.
I have one of those too.
Cheers. Yeah, exactly. 2 years. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I got to add them all up. Shit, I got to include that one too.
Oh, man. Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. It's such a, you know, and when you come to think of it, it's like, what else could have happened? Like that was bound to happen. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you're in that place. You're just, you know, running from pillar to post, hoping in some frantic frenzy, you're going to find a way to get out of the haze. And that something else out there, someone else out there is going to be the person who will save me. Well, it wasn't mom, it wasn't dad, it wasn't the college professor, and it wasn't, you know, it's going to be now this person and this shiny object and that shiny man and whatever, you know. And it never is until you really get to know who you are and who, you know, what you want, which, who you really are. And who you really are does not depend on these people that are outside of you. It's only on that one person that you are. And so, you know, that was when that marriage was falling apart, that's when I got a call from my dad, of all people, to suggest that he had actually taken a class in something called Reiki, which is an energy healing modality. And he thought it would be something I would love. I would enjoy. And I got so angry. I got so mad. I'm like, how dare you? How dare you come to me and tell me what would be good for me? And I did that whole thing because it was like, you have some gall, you have some audacity. However, part that was me on the external, but on the internal, I'm like, okay, let's just see what this is about. And so not in his city, but in my city, which was Bombay, but at that point, I found a local teacher and I went to a workshop with this complete, like, you know, disengaged student, you know, breakfast club kind, where I'm like, I'm here, but I really don't want to be here. I'm like, this is bullshit. I'm just going to, you know, I had no respect for the teacher at all. I was basically there to prove my dad was full of shit. And that this was, you know, but that's not fully true, because there was obviously something that had me pay the 2,000 rupees, had me take the time to spend a whole weekend at this workshop. There was that part of me that actually had the wheels moving forward while my inner child was kicking and screaming and rebelling. I did the class, came away, and then a few months after that, I started to notice a change in my health. My skin was lightening up. I had, my allergies were literally just not showing up again. My body ache, my pain, my fatigue was going away. I was sleeping much better. I had been smoking, I had been drinking, I had been, you know, I'd wake up and grab a pack. You can't imagine, just picture this, I mean, me waking up and grabbing a pack of cigarettes and starting my day off. And it was a daily thing, coffee, you know, just keeping it going. Just, I had that really hard lifestyle back when I was in Bombay, and that's how I was coping with whatever I was coping with. And I started to realize I'm not needing this anymore, and I'm wanting to spend more time in this other thing. And I wasn't so sure what this other thing even was at the time. And so I, you know, just kind of like got a little humble, and I called that teacher back again, and I said, I want to do it again. And so then about a few months later, I go back, and this time I actually go there and I actually pay attention. I'm listening and I'm engaged, and I really then understood, wow, this is a real thing. Like, this energy is flowing. I do feel my hands are getting warm. It's immediately making a difference, and I'm feeling something. This is not nothing. This was 1995, so 25 years ago. And that was the first time I came into connection with Reiki, energy, and healing. I had done yoga and chanting and meditation my whole life. I did it through school and at home and with my grandparents. And I had my yoga, meditation, chanting. And, you know, one of those things that that they're so you that you forget they're the thing, you know? And so even though I had a yoga, meditation, chanting practice, I didn't look to that as my tools at the time initially. So when I came across Reiki, which was this new thing, it took me out of my bubble and had me see myself in this now new appreciative way of like, oh, okay. All right. You are worthy. You do have this. You have these resources. You have this ability, and you have the, you can transform. You can feel better, you know? And this reminder, it came from that other, to be able to step outside and look back at yourself. So that started my journey. And from 95 onwards to now, I don't know, I've probably done over 25 trainings and courses and certifications in all kinds of modalities and body work and transformation, meditation and coaching and trauma and on and on. There's a long list of trainings I've done. So every single one of them has helped me fine tune and see new layers and acknowledge, because, you know, we're not static beings. We're changing, we're evolving every single day, every multiple times a day. And how can I get present to what's here now? Because only through that can I access anything else. Mm-hmm. And when I can feel like, oh, this suddenly showed up, like, huh, I wonder where that is coming from. So this curiosity and this ability to have self-inquiry and ability to maybe not judge or jump has come over time. You know, I was the first one to lash out and curse and attack and get even violent sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I can have compassion for who I've been, and knowing that I've been to those dark places. I have been to many, many dark places, both as a child, as an adult. And I know what it's taken for me personally to develop new practices and new habits and new lifestyle, and to transform and to be in charge and control my life, my outcomes, my destiny, because it's completely doable. It's completely doable. And I'm, you know, feel very blessed, because as my children grow older, like my daughter's going to be 16, and every milestone of hers is like, all right, yeah, we can do this. It's me raising myself as a, you know, as a parent, because I didn't get that. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But it's, you know, how do I raise myself? You know, we talk about raising children. I don't think we need to worry about that. I think we need to raise ourselves. Raising parents is really an important thing. Raising conscious parents. It's like, because no one else is going to do it. I always say that I was born into motherhood the day my daughter was born. Mm-hmm. I might be 47, but I'm not only a 16-year-old mother. Because I'm only as old, you know, I came into motherhood the day she was born. So to have this expectation that I have to be perfect, I have to drop that. And I have to just be there to listen and be present. So it's been, I have so much gratitude. That's the biggest thing, you know, that I know that I'm not going to, you know, minimize the trauma that happened in my life. In fact, when I wrote my book, my best friend Lisa, who helped me edit it and then helped me, I was like, last minute before it was going, I'm like, let's just brainstorm this tagline, because the tagline is, the title is Coming Home to the Heart, but the tagline is Transforming Trauma into the Infinite Possibilities for Healing. And I told her, Lisa, trauma, are you sure? Like, that seems like a very big word for this book. Do you think it's a bit...
Trauma is a big word for your story?
Yeah. I said, do you think this sounds a bit exaggerated? Oh, and she literally, I mean, there was such a long pause on that call. She said, Richa, you realize, right, that what happened to you was trauma? Like, you know, it was abuse. I mean, I know it's sexual abuse, but I don't know. And she really had to, like, can you imagine, like, I'd already written.
Oh, I'm laughing now at you thinking, like, not because it's funny, but it's also like, seriously, come on, Richa.
This is the thing. We don't know how to name it. Mm. I couldn't name it. Because I couldn't put my parents in that bracket of they caused me such harm. I couldn't, because I had an image of my life and of them. And even though that was something I did to cope, it was still something that I had created so I could feel safe. When that got pulled off or ripped off, it kind of just had me confront that, oh, okay, all right, let me just be with that. Let's leave that word in there. And it makes, obviously, now, 5 years later, of course, it makes sense, more than sense, and it's absolutely appropriate. It was big T trauma. Like, you know, a lot of trauma specialists say big T, small T, small T. Big T is these big incidents, war, rape, you know, abuse like this. Small T is, you know, moving home or lost my keys, or, you know, I'm creating extreme examples to just show there's a huge range in between. But yeah, this definitely classifies as big T. And I didn't, I didn't name it. It was never told to me. I was never told, hey, you've been through trauma. Never. And this was like when? 5 years ago, I was like 40 something already. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's been such a journey. And I have, if I have gratitude today for this moment that I'm sitting with you, I mean, and we're speaking and we're having this crazy vulnerable conversation right now, and this is going out to who knows how many people, thousands of people. The fact that this is happening and I'm so grateful for this, then by virtue of just this, how I feel right now, I am fully grateful for everything that has led me to this moment. Mm-hmm.
And it's a mind-blowing, it's mind-blowing for people. I know it's sometimes, because I think some folks, it's more guilt and shame. How do I get to be happy after having had all of these negative experiences? Like, who allows that for me to happen, right? And if I suddenly am able to transform that into something that's positive and forward, do I deny and diminish all the pain and the suffering that I felt, right? So it's like, this binary choices that people sometimes feel that they have to make, that in order to honor, you know, this terrible abuse, I have to hold it and I have to chew on it every day. And I have to make sure that it still burns every day, because if I suddenly move forward and I'm grateful for it, it's almost as if I'm telling the abusers, hey, you know, no big deal. You didn't fuck my life up or anything. Like, all's good. I'm ready to go on. And it's not that simple. Like, you can hold both and probably will for some time. Yes. But, you know, the ability to be able to sit back, take a deep breath. And, you know, and I tell people, like, listening to your stories, like, my own body goes up and down as I listen to you speak. I mean, I feel my own, like, hearing you and going, God, I feel so terrible for you inside, you know, just, I can't imagine all of that. But then, you know, my skin tingles when you talk about gratitude, because I get that as well. Like, being able to move on and move past it doesn't mean you're necessarily forgiving everything. You're diminishing that. You're just seeing how that fortified you in a way that you can move forward from it. And it can do that. Like, for everybody, just it takes time for many people to get to that place, you know. So much in your story, you know, there's as I was listening to it and I was thinking, you know, we were tackling this from a lot of the cultural taboos, and yet when I've talked with a lot of people that have had similar experiences in terms of molestation and sexual abuse, their stories, regardless of culture and even gender, you know, have had some similar themes to it, which is the you know, the parents not wanting it to get out in the open and not wanting to talk about it. But when you landed on the school and having people in the field that, you know, quote, should know better, also saying, ooh, we don't want to go there. That blew my mind, you know, that would be even something that you'd be approached with. And then it makes me wonder, of course, then how often, you know, and how underserved, you know, there are so many more people like you, you know, coming out of that community, that may have ran into the same ideas.
And I can't imagine, I've got all these things here. Like, I can't imagine watching your dad evolve from being your perpetrator to being somebody who was respected and regarded as, you know, being pious and, you know, and not being that kind of a person and knowing you couldn't say shit about that, you know, like, God, what, just that part made me feel just so sick for you. You know, to know that, I mean, I've seen that myself with people that I've, you know, had to deal with abuses from, and to everybody else, they look like the nice person, charismatic, funny. And you're just like, no, and your whole body just like curdles, you know, from the inside out at that thought that you could even tell everybody what was going on and no one would still believe you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was our family MO. I mean, that's how we showed up. You know, we'd get compliments everywhere we went. Oh, what a lovely family. What a beautiful family. You know, this, we presented, we performed as a family. We had these beautiful family pictures and vacations. We were a family of actors. We frankly were a family of actors. We are all actually actors, all five of us. My mother's a director, writer, and this is for real. Okay, my dad's been in TV and film and commercials, and you know, and both my brothers are in some way, shape, or form. We've all been performers, so this was literally, we were performing. You know, my brothers didn't know, obviously, but and in a way, my mom was also directing. She was the director of this whole thing, and that happened for a while, and then. The thing about, like, even in the book that I write is that I share all this only to give context. My main thing that I share, that is the whole reason to share the context, is to share that how it all changed, how mm-hmm. and when it all transformed, and how that even though my dad and I had that journey, that today it's not like that. And of course, the abuse stopped happening, but I later found out that he was abused as a child by men, by boys, and had that in his childhood. So he had to go get help for that. And he still is. He's still working on himself. But also how it was my dad who brought me my first spiritual teacher, who became my Reiki master and then became the one who initiated me into my many modalities. So it's very interesting to look at how, you know, all this fell into place. Like, even right now, I'm in a place called Ojai in Southern California. And the reason I'm here is because of a teacher called Krishnamurti. And my dad introduced me to Krishnamurti when I was little. I went to a Krishnamurti school in India because my dad loved Krishnamurti. And so the thing about holding the love and the shame, it's a journey, you know, it's a journey, because if someone comes and tells you, oh, you got to stop that, you got to forgive and forget, I don't buy that. Because for a long time, I did that. And I completely denied my healing process. I completely denied my grieving process, the grief of loss of life, the grief of loss of my childhood, the grief of loss of relationship. When I see some kids with their dads and I see some dads with their daughters, I always go, well, I never had that and I never will, and that's okay. Only now can I say, you know, I never had that and I never will, and that's okay. But for a long time, that caused me so much sadness. And then this extra pressure I put on my husband to be the perfect dad to my daughters, because I'm like, you don't know what it's like to not have that, so you've got to be... da 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 da, and all of that drama that happened in my relationship because with my husband, my new husband, my latest husband, my most recent one.
The most recent.
They've only been two. This one I'm, you know, I'm still with.
You're going to keep this one, you think?
Yeah, yeah, keep this okay. One. Warranty expired. It's 19 years now.
You're stuck with it.
It's so interesting because I actually met my husband, this one, when we were 4 years old. Aww. And we were friends. We were just buddies, you know. We had play dates. My mother and mother-in-law were actually best friends. And we were just buddies and we had play dates and we went swimming and we were just friends. And when I had my first divorce, when the first marriage fell apart and I had a divorce and I was just doing my holistic work and my acting and my film and that's all, that's it. I was in no relationships, nothing. That's when we got reconnected. And after a long gap, and he had already moved to the US, and that's when we got connected. And that was about 20 years ago. And so that's when we, you know, he proposed and I said, okay, let's do it. And then that's when I moved to the US.
Cool.
So yeah, I don't know how I got digressed into that, but we were talking about something else.
You were putting pressure on him to be the perfect dad.
Oh, yes.
And then
putting pressure on him. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. At least one of us is keeping things on track.
It's my job.
Thank God. Thank God for you. So it's just that, you know, just the pressure, the mental and psychological pressure on wanting something so badly because it's unhealed in you, and that it was unhealed in me. I remember before I started writing my book, I would wake up on Father's Day and like with nightmares, like it would be Father's Day morning. I'd have like these nightmares. And I had 3 years in a row dreams that my father died, my real father died. And I'm processing after he's dead. And he's well and alive right now, but I've been processing that he's dead. And I'm asking myself in my post father died moment in my dream, did I have anything left? Did I have to finish anything else? Did I have to say anything else to him? Did we still have something left to uncover? Did we do our work? And that was what was bothering me. Not the fact that he had a heart attack or he died, but the fact that did we miss something? Is there something more we could have done to restore our relationship? That's the dream I woke up with. And it was so weird. It was like, where is this coming from? Like, who cares? Why do I, like, you know, I have kids, I have a husband, I'm, you know, doing life. Like, you know, what's the matter? It happened every year for 3 years. And something there then, you know, was shifting for me. And I was like, okay, I think this is inviting me into maybe the next round of healing and the next round of repair work and looking at myself and where am I in my recovery and what's really happening. What's really happening? Because it's never really like, you know, it's not like done and you're like, you know, put it away in a box. And there's no separation in our emotional body, if you will. Emotional body is one being, one energetic field. And we, you know, very often it's like, okay, this is just me having emotions for this and this and separating. It doesn't work that way. Mm-mm. If I'm not complete with this, then I'm not going to be complete with any of this. And it's really about a holistic systemic healing so that I can fully thrive. And the only way to do that is by doing the inner work on me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about that because I want to hear about the process for working with you because you are a coach and you do offer courses to be able to help guide people through their own healing journey. And I, you know, I agree with that it comes in these waves, you know, that's, it's a mosaic of irregular pieces that actually come together that create our entire experience. And you don't know which piece you may be working on and how it actually connects to other pieces. And it's not like a smooth connection sometimes. It's like jagged edges that wedge in there and, you know, grout in between to fill in the space. And I mean, and at some point when you can pull back every once in a while and look at the mosaic as it's coming together, and the next thing you know, you're back in trying to find the next few pieces for it. And that self-awareness of not only noticing, but like you said there, I love that to see that, you know, there are these energetic signals we do get from the universe for us that kind of pushes us and kind of like turns our head in the direction that we should be, or it's something that we hear. And I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I'll clarify this. Like I have always felt like spiritual as a person. I, you know, going to church on Sundays, no, not my thing. Do I, you know, claim one religious, you know, no, never been that. But I have also been so open-hearted and open-minded to understand that there are these unexplained things out there if you allow them to happen and not be so skeptical, that maybe there's more to this. And when I think about, you know, Eastern religions and cultures that have had these types of awareness building, you know, through meditation, and Buddhism was something that I started to read on, you know, about 20 years ago for myself, and awareness and presence and impermanence and flow and all of that stuff. And I think that has contributed to my own journey in this, that it hasn't just been sitting in a therapist chair, you know, spilling out my guts or reading psychology white papers, but it's been the intersection of the science of, you know, neurobiology with the studies of psychology with some energy awareness of the universe and all this power we do have inside ourselves, even in the brain, in wavelengths that we don't even know how to fully capture, but a lot of these modalities have captured them. And then when you do bring them together, it's profound. I mean, it can be very surprising and profound for people who only want to bucket their healing one way or another, that they only want to do it this way or that way. And that looks weird and strange. And so when you talk about what you do, what kind of people respond then to this that you find when you're working with them? Because I see, like I said, I felt it. Sometimes the universe does give you a signal. For me, it was when my daughter leaned her head on my shoulder and I bristled, that I knew that I needed to change as a mom. Like, my daughter's relationship to me was telling me about how bad my relationship was, and that it was making me, and, you know, putting me in a situation where I couldn't mother her the way I needed to. So like you or your daughters were your trigger, my daughter was my trigger too, that I needed to be present and to understand what it meant to be a mom. And so I'm behind how you approach this, but can you talk to people about this and, you know, who responds well to this?
Yeah. You know, if you find yourself getting over and over again stopped by a repetitive thought pattern that's coming from your past experiences or something that you, some sort of beliefs that you've formed because of events that happened in your past or from childhood or from a long time ago that aren't happening anymore. And if you find yourself being blocked again and again, over and over, and finding yourself like circling the drain of your life, you know that you need to have a breakthrough. You need, and maybe actually you don't even know you need to have a breakthrough. I'm telling you, you need a breakthrough. You just may be at the effect of a repetitive, unhealthy pattern in your life. And when I work with people, I get them to see what that is and actually break out of it. And I have ways that I do that with people. But if you find yourself stuck and you know, this is not what my life's supposed to be, this isn't what I wanted, this isn't how I saw myself at this age, this stage, I didn't expect to be in a relationship like this or in a job like this or not making enough money like this. You know, things that are lacking, missing, feeling like just the heaviness and weight, it can be shifted. And that's the kind of person that I really can help guide through a process, body, mind, spirit process that helps them not just change and break through, but transform. And I want to point out a distinction between transform and change, because when you change, you can change back. When you transform, you don't go back. Because when you've transformed, you can't unsee now what you have seen. It's like when you go on that hike and you've seen those views and you've been in that moment of being one with nature, you can't ever erase that from your mind. It's like that. When I had my transformation moment was actually when I went to my first retreat ever that my dad actually had me sign up for, not had me sign up for. He said, you should do this. And I was like, no, not going to do it. And then I did it anyway. That first morning when I did a meditation and I was given an opportunity to experience what it is to actually have an emotional release and start to let go and actually be, for the first time, allow myself to see my pain, was the first day, that was the day that I had a hairpin bend in my journey. And so I know it's possible, and it comes through body, mind, spirit. It comes from being willing and open to doing something different, doing something new, trying something you've never tried before, because my practices are not, I don't share them publicly. They are a very sacred spiritual practice that I only teach when I'm with my groups and in person or over Zoom. And so these practices are very powerful and can help people heal not only their own life trauma, but even further. You can even go deeper in generational trauma, and it can end with you. Like it can, you can change the tide. You can change what happens for your future generations and their generations forward by you being the change right now, you being the transformed being now. Mm-hmm. Not tomorrow, not next year, now.
Love it. I do. I love it. You're working on a trauma summit, and I want to give you a chance to talk about that, because by the time the listeners, if you guys are all watching and listening to this as the episode drops here in 2020, Richa actually has a trauma summit where she's bringing together a lot of people. I am involved in it, but I'm one of many, many people that are in there. Talk about that and what the dates are and how people can get it. And the links will be in the show notes for this. And then, of course, once the trauma summit passes, I'll have to go back in and edit my podcast notes. But since it's relevant today to us in 2020. Talk about that for a bit here as we start to conclude.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for mentioning that. That's it's called Freedom from Trauma. And the goal was to bring powerful conversations and profound practices to the people to heal their trauma and create lives that they truly love and desire. And you know, it's great to have you on it and bring your perspective. And like that, I've interviewed speakers and authors, experts in both Western psychological and modern modalities, as well as Eastern esoteric, you know, yoga, meditation, shamanism, just a blend of different paths and ways and modalities to bring people just so many options and so many ways to get unstuck and out of their place of the hardship and the despair of trauma and silently suffering. So they can have, you know, even if one pearl of wisdom, one little nugget helps one person, I'd be super, you know, grateful. And so that's really the goal. And it starts on September 21. And we're, you know, the link is available, like you said. And I'll be offering actually free live meditations every day in my Facebook groups and pages as well. So people are, you know, welcome to join for that. And also the over 35 speakers that we'll have in various topics that they can watch, engage in, ask questions. It's going to be really incredible. I'm so grateful. And thank you so much for being part of it, Ami.
Oh, well, I'm flattered that you asked. You know, my contribution, like I said, is just one of many that's coming in there. I encourage it for people to think about jumping in and doing it, because again, you know, there is so many different ways to be able to approach when you have an ardent desire to transform your life. It doesn't, like you said, it doesn't just happen. What happens is you start. That's the one certainty that you have. Where it goes and how deep and rich you get out of it is always evolving and is dependent, I think, on your, again, having an open mind and being able to view yourself and your experience like almost from a third person and curiosity. And so for people that have, you know, have gone through this healing journey on a certain way, it's always great to have these kinds of opportunities like what you're bringing, which is to be able to see so many different ways to integrate it together or to change directions. Because, you know, usually it is just a kernel and a nugget that just flashes off and then just starts a whole nother pathway for you. And you don't know when it is, where it's coming from. And so, you know, I spoke with Lindsay Gibson on my last episode, and she talks about it as being a radio dial. You know, the only way you ever find your dial is you got to turn it. You know, you got to be searching for it. And so the summit is a great opportunity for people to be able to, you know, get that dial going and to search and listen in on maybe a couple of other things. And because you don't know, you really don't. I don't know what the next step will be for me ever. But I do know that I'm always keeping my antenna tuned to hear what it is. And I think that, you know, meeting you and talking to you is definitely, like I said, when I get goosebumps, and it means that there's a signal, you know, there is something powerful that's actually happening. And so talking with you and getting to know you and adding you into my life has definitely given me a little bit of the tingles in my antenna system there. So I appreciate that.
I love that. I love tingles.
Those are great. Well,
as you said that, I hear the birds chirping. That's a good sign.
Right. It's a Disney movie now, just erupted in here. Songs are going to start breaking out.
Tweet, tweet.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you so much. You're sharing your story with everybody so that we could actually hear and understand, again, the context of what your life has been, your triumph over that, and you're continuing to be able to give that back for other people that need that. So I encourage everybody, again, the links for Richa will be in the show. And so if there's a direction that you feel like she can take you, then by all means, please do reach out to her and learn more about her. And I'll have all of the social media links as well, and also to this trauma summit. And so it's been amazing to have you here, and I appreciate you so much. And so thank you.
Thank you for having me, Amy. This was lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com. And there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quiracone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.